Podcast.
The Novel Ideas Podcast, a podcast for two siblings who love books.
So sorry we're late again. I thought we were only a week late, and then I looked on the website, and I was like, oh, we're 2 weeks late.
We, shit, as it turns out, are not good at deadlines when there's not a grade. We're
Well, I was thinking about it, and I was like, this is strange, because I felt like there was a big span of time where we very consistently read a book a week, and I'm going to blame it on the fact that I've been too busy to do a lot of things. I know wedding planning's a lame excuse, but it's my excuse.
And Valentine's week was definitely one of those weeks where I had a lot of work stuff going on, too.
Yeah.
Because all of you just have to send flowers and chocolate.
I didn't.
I get stuck at work for 10 hours instead of 3.
I got off work on Valentine's Day, and I went to Walgreens to pick up a prescription, and I was like, oh, it's Valentine's Day, and I bought a bar of, like, Hershey's dark chocolate, and then I came home, and I was like, Happy Valentine's Day. I want some of that. And that was our Valentine's Day.
Happy Valentine's Day. I bought me chocolate. You can't have any.
Scott's like, well, I was going to buy it. He actually went to the store to buy me flowers, and they only had roses and didn't have tulips, and he was offended, so he didn't get anything. I was like, that's almost a better present.
I believe roses are traditional.
Well, tulips are my favorite flowers, so
well,
that's why he...
All right.
Wanted to do that. And I was just complaining a couple weeks ago that he's never bought me flowers ever, and he felt bad. Oh. Anyway. This week we're talking about Their Eyes Were Watching God. A classic of American fiction by Zora Neale Hurston.
I keep wanting to call her Houston. I was going to say that, but I wanted to double check the cover to make sure.
And I guess it's definitely a more, like, what you might call a modern classic.
A 20th century classic.
Yeah. Set early 1900s, but according to some of the reading, Ben and I actually did a little bit of extra reading because both of our books contain forewords and afterwards.
As many classics, assigned reading type of books do.
Uh-huh. So as opposed to, like, the zero amount of research we usually do, we did, you know, like 5% by reading everything in the book.
You see, we're not opposed to research. If you put words in front of our faces, we'll read them.
It's true.
That's part of why we're here to begin with.
So, I think it was in the afterword, it was saying that the book came out, was kind of put Hurston on the map for a while, then it kind of fell out of fashion. Her other stuff wasn't super well received, and she ended up dying in a fair amount of obscurity, and the book kind of went underground for, like, 20 years or so before, oh, shit, who was it? There was a woman who wrote, an article in, like, 76 about, like, searching for Zora Neale Hurston and, like, went and found her grave and it was unmarked and, like, talked about the significance of Their Eyes Were Watching God and kind of brought it back into vogue and people started reading it in
August 1973. Alice Walker discovers and marks Hurston's grave. There it is.
There it is.
75 is when the article was published, launching the revival.
Okay, so I was close.
You were very, very close.
75. Yeah, people started paying attention to her again, and Their Eyes Were Watching God in particular kind of jumped up to social recognition, and it's now, I understand, really common to have as assigned reading, so that was one of the reasons that we chose it.
Yeah, I've run into at least a couple people since I started reading this book weeks ago, where they said, oh yeah, I had to read that in school.
Yeah. And I seem to remember that I tried to check it out once, like, in August or September, because I had a student who was reading it, and so I originally was going to read along with them, and then all of the copies of the library were checked out, because all the high schoolers had it checked out for their assigned reading, so, yeah. I never had to read it in school.
Yeah, me neither. Actually, this is the first time I've read it.
Yeah, me too, but I think it was an Oprah Book Club book, I want to say.
I wouldn't be surprised. Point. Seems to fit a certain profile.
So, I definitely heard of it before, but I never read it. And we basically chose it because it is a classic and assigned reading. I could have sworn it was a listener suggestion, but I don't think it was.
I think it might have been, actually.
Oh, really?
Yeah, but...
Would you have taken it off the list if it...
It's probably still up there.
I don't know.
I don't remember. I don't write down who suggests the books. So I don't know who suggested it, but...
We just have, like, a list.
I'm pretty sure it's on the suggestions page somewhere.
Okay.
Or it will be until next time I clean up the webpage. So by the time this is posted, it probably won't be there anymore. Giggle.
So, I guess we'll start talking about it.
Yeah. So it's, I guess we've mentioned it's kind of a classic, a...
Literary fiction.
Literary, so-called literary fiction. Maybe a bit of a coming-of-age type of story, though in this case it's coming-of-age. It's more like self-realization because she comes of age when she's almost 40 instead of, like, 14.
Yeah, I was going to say, it's not like, it's not like, this is the summer I became a woman
right.
kind of coming-of-age. It's more like, this is how the course of a woman's life taught her how to be the way she wants to be.
Right. I'm sure someone out there has called this women's literature before, or...
Oh, yeah, I'm sure.
Or black literature, or black women's literature, or whatever the term would be.
I think it's also sometimes deemed as a romantic literature, because I remember seeing a couple things where people said, like, they read it for the love story aspects, so...
Interesting.
I wouldn't read it for the love story aspect, not because I think, like, the love story is necessarily bad, but that didn't really seem to be the point, so...
Right.
But, not to say you're wrong if you read for the love story.
It's kind of a cute little love story.
It's nice. I like the fact that it ends up being an older woman and a younger man.
Right, yeah.
It's pretty sweet.
That is the reverse of what it always is.
And the book even talks about that at length, because I guess there was another character that you never get to meet, but everyone knew this other woman who had fallen in love with a younger man and ran off with him, and then ended up that he was a piece of crap and, like, stole our money and basically left her to die, and...
Right.
Everyone's like, that's gonna happen to you, Janie! Do you remember what happened to Miss So-and-so? And she's like, I'm fine. And then ends up working out, though.
Right. So, I guess we should... jump into the plot synopsis.
So I tried to write a plot synopsis, disclaimer, in the dialect the book is written in, because Ben and I both struggled a little bit reading the dialect.
Yes.
So that's why I kind of wrote the plot synopsis in dialect. And I guess you don't get the same effect hearing it rather than seeing it, but I tried.
So am I going to attempt this?
Yeah.
All right. I spec you have some problems reading this here tale.
You just kind of sound like a southern.
Yeah, I sound more like Foghorn Leghorn than a turn of the century black man.
Well, yeah.
Go figure. Well, I said many times already that this dialect coming out of Zora Neale Hurston's pen is dialect coming out of me. It's almost racist.
Yeah.
Like, even though that is the furthest thing from my intent, like, I almost can't reproduce it in a way that sounds natural.
Yeah, unlike the other books we've read when Ben and I have had fun trying to do horrible accents. I don't think we'll try it with this book, because it'll just make us sound like dicks.
Well, I don't have anything to compare it to, for one thing.
Yeah, that's one thing I was thinking while I was reading it, is that it's tough to read because it's written basically phonetically, like, exactly the way you might hear someone saying it. So the spelling's usually, like, not the way you're used to seeing it, and there's apostrophes instead of letters and stuff. But I think if you actually just heard people speaking it, you would understand it a lot better.
Yeah, and I'd have to read this whole book aloud probably 5 times before it would come out naturally enough for it to sound like words instead of me phonetically sounding it out.
Yeah.
Which, again, is part of the difficulty in me reading it, probably.
Mm-hmm. When I read Gone with the Wind, I don't know, 5 years ago or whenever I read it, I was telling Ben that all the slaves in that book speak in a dialect similar to what's in this book, and, you know, all the slave owners talk like proper Southerners or whatever.
Right.
But the first time I sat down with it, I was like, what the hell is going on here? And I actually ended up reading out loud all of the slaves' lines for, like, the first 50 pages of the books, or until I kind of got the hang of it. Kind of just have to, like, sound it out sometimes.
Yeah, I got better at it as it went along, but it never flowed real naturally.
Yeah.
It was also a little, I seem to recall, it's been forever since it's been since high school since I read the book, but I was thinking Jim and Huck Finn used that dialect as well.
Yeah.
It's like, I know I've seen some of this, or, oh gosh, I just thought of, like, a Harry Turtle Dove uses a watered-down version of that dialect for a lot of his American black characters and some of his alternate history books that are placed back around that time period, too. But he's a white history professor. Sorry, not a professor of white history. He's a white man who is a history professor. And his version of the dialect is toned down a little bit. A white history professor, good lord. Or all history professors up to a certain point, probably.
Basically. That's what I was going to say. Why isn't there a white history month?
We have one of those arguments.
We did not actually read this book for Black History Month, by the way. That was, I guess, not our intention.
I guess that's coincidental.
Yeah, we just kind of stumbled upon it.
We do try to read books that are not by white guys, at least some of the time.
Yeah, this and in Fledgling, we're doing okay for ourselves. So my brief summary, which I've gone back to English and I'm no longer going to try to do dialect. So Janie is the main character. She hits a certain... Well, she takes the book basically growing and realizing, like, her idea of what life is about and what she wants to be, rather than what people say she should be. And she kind of does this over the course of 3 marriages. The first one takes such a short time, like, it's not that significant, but basically makes her realize she doesn't want to be stuck in this traditional country backwoods marriage, escapes that, lives through her second one where her husband wants her to be more of this figure piece rather than her getting to be a person, and then through her third husband, she gets to realize that she can act the way she wants to act and be who she wants to be. And so, although there are some what you consider, like, traditional plot points of, like, someone going from point A to point B and doing stuff, the journey of the book is more of, like, the emotional inner journey. So there's not, like, a whole lot of action happening.
Right. It's not Janie goes to place X and goes through all of these hardships, these events. It's Janie goes to place X and exists for a while and feels about it.
Yeah. Married to this dude for 20 years and realizes, oh, that sucked.
Not doing that again.
So, setting, in case you couldn't tell from the context earlier, is set in the American South. Mostly in Florida. First in, and I don't remember the name of the town she lives in. The all-black town she...
Eatonville?
Eaton,
right. Or just Eaton? One of those.
But it's a town in Florida.
Yeah, and, Eatonville.
Okay, Eatonville. And then later she's in the Everglades. So she's mostly in Florida for the entirety of the book. In the early 1900s.
Yeah. And so, well, let's talk about Janie some.
Yeah.
The protagonist, by the way, I'm going out of order a tiny bit, unless we said that. Hell, I don't know.
yes, Ben?
I don't even know. Probably...
You were so excited to call her the protagonist.
I know.
And then you just petered out.
I know. I guess I'm going to cut that out, probably. So the protagonist of this book is Janie.
Yes.
The person who starred in the plot... So the real plot summary.
Yes.
And Janie is, I guess she'd, you would assume, a more or less typical young black woman growing up, having some relatives and experiences that are, you know, familiar.
I liked her realization when she was like 7 or 8 that she and her grandma lived on the property with this white family, because her grandma was essentially like a nanny or a maid to this white family. And Janie didn't realize she was black until she was 7, and she was looking at a picture of the family, and she was like, "Where am I?" They're like, "You're the black little girl."
She's like, "Whoa, no shit."
I'm black?
Holy cow. which implies to me that this particular white family was maybe a little more inclusive than some would be.
Yeah. Well, you know, they gave her clothes and apparently never bothered to tell her she was less than them, because
apparently she didn't know. Apparently ran around with the other kids doing the same things the other kids did. But she comes to a realization one day. she kind of...
I like this plot.
Yes. Observing the bees and the blossoms. And suddenly has this, I guess you'd say, sexual awakening.
Yeah.
And pretty much has to kiss the first boy or man she sees, which leads to her grandmother freaking out.
Yeah, she's watching the bees pollinating the flowers, and all of a sudden it's just like, I understand sex. I think she says, like, she thinks that this is what marriage is or something.
Yeah, yeah.
She's a little more poetic than... I understand sex, and yeah, like, goes and wanders out near the gate and sees this kid about her age, is like, "Hey, come here," and kisses him. And then her grandma witnesses her first kiss and is like, "Okay, you have to get married now, so you can't cause trouble."
Come on,
grandma.
That's right. And so she gets married off very quickly to this older man, much older.
Yeah, we should mention she's, like, 16.
Yeah.
Her grandma does not waste time.
Yeah, puts her with this, like, 50-year-old guy, probably, and... Mm-hmm. I mean, his main quality is that... he owns a bunch of land.
He has 60 acres, so he is twice as much as the, 30 acres.
Because the standard... homesteader. The standard Negro homesteader.
Yes. The 30 acres and a mule promise. A lot of black writers like to mess around with that idea in their stories, because that is not what happened.
Right.
But Logan Killix, this guy is so great. He has 60 acres.
That's
right.
He has
twice as much as he needs.
What's not to like? I mean, the fact that you don't, you know, care about him at all.
Yeah, that you're 16 and he's like 15 gross,
yeah,
and wants you to, like, help out with all this farm work that you've never done before.
Right.
That kind of sucks.
That does. And she leaves. So, I mean, basically she just ups and leaves.
Mm-hmm.
He never dies off. They never get divorced. She just goes away, actually.
Yeah, and I guess the thing about him...
Letter of the law. She is a bigamist.
True. Oh, he's probably dead before
the
end of the book.
Dies off before Joe does, probably.
Yeah. One of the things I think is kind of interesting about him is that he's not necessarily, like, a bad husband. We kind of talked about in The Awakening how the main character in that, like, her husband's not, like, a bad dude who's horrible to her. She just... like, isn't in love and happy in her marriage. And it's kind of the same deal here, where, like, this guy, like, he's fairly nice for, like, nice to her, and he doesn't beat her or hit her or, like, force her to have sex with him or anything, but he's just this, like, old dude that she doesn't care about, so she doesn't want to be married to him. And she doesn't want to, like, live in the country away from everybody else. So, but the kind of, I think the lesson that he taught her... because at the beginning it's talking about women, like, realizing dreams and, like, what they can't have and stuff. And, it says that when Janie married Logan Killix, that she realized you don't have to be in love with the person you're married to, and that killed her first dream.
Right. Yeah. And, well, Janie, bad news. A lot of dream killing to go before you go. So she meets this smooth-talking younger guy. Very ambitious. It'd be as good time as any to talk about Joe. We can come back to Janie in a minute, I think.
Yeah.
Because a lot of her character comes out of exploring her journey, and it's mm-hmm. really the purpose of the book. So I guess that makes sense. But, you know, they go to Eatonville, this all-black town they've heard about, and Joe shows up and immediately, all right, who's the mayor? Where's the post office? What's going on with this stuff? And everyone's like, what? We don't know what you're talking about. He's like, oh, well, I'll be right back. And
he goes off and buys, like, 200 acres right? of land. And
almost, like, cartoonishly disappears in a puff of dust and comes back. And he's like, all right, now we're incorporated. Here's where this is going. Here's where this is going. We need to choose a mayor. And they're like, well, I guess that should be you. All right, so that's me.
I'm going to build a house right here, and we're going to set up a post office. And
so Joe really does do a lot of good things. He turns out maybe not be the ideal husband for Janie, but
yeah.
he does more or less scratch out an actual town out of a few dudes sitting around, like, a couple of abandoned lots.
Yeah, it's true.
So he does accomplish some things in his life.
And he is, like, at times a little forward-thinking. Like, I mean, some of the stuff that he's doing he does for show, or because he wants people to come and, like, see it and think, you know, oh, man, this town and the mayor of this town is great, because he loves people thinking he's great.
He definitely enjoys being the big man.
Yeah, but that doesn't necessarily mean he's doing bad stuff, because, you know, he's, well, we need a post office, and someone says, well, whoever heard of a black man running a post office? And he's like, hey, you ignorant piece of shit, like, we're going to run a post office. It's like, some of this stuff is, like, fairly progressive, of, like, on his part. Even if he's doing it just so, like, he can feel self-important, like...
Well, sure.
He's still doing some good stuff, so... and he's definitely very, well, the way he, like, plans and, makes a name and makes money for himself, he's kind of crafty, because he sets up the store in town and, sets it up so that he's just making all of his money back that he spent on those, you know, 200 odd acres, and by the time he dies, Janie is essentially a rich widow, so he did pretty good for himself.
That's true, and he dies of something that people still die of today, which is being too stubborn to go to the doctor.
I didn't think it was ever specified. Oh, yes, he did die of being too stubborn to go to the doctor.
That's actually... But if you'd come seen a real doctor like a year before, you might have been okay.
Joe and T-Cake both died of being too stubborn to go to a doctor.
That's true, actually.
Men actually... The married men live longer than single men because their wives force them to go to the doctor.
Oh, good Lord. That's the only reason I'm not going to die young. Someone's going to make me go to the doctor someday.
Go to the doctor.
Ben! Okay.
I've said that line many, many times.
Yes. I've heard that line many times. Not even for you.
Yeah, not to you, but... Scott, go to the doctor. I'll see how this works out, and then maybe I'll go, no, go to the doctor. Damn it, man.
I don't want to go to the doctor. The doctor sucks.
It does. It's kind of a pain in the ass to schedule.
That's true.
I would agree. But sometimes you just have to go to the fucking doctor.
Right. When you're on the 10th day of feeling bad, it's time to do something.
If a weird dog bites you in the face, go to the doctor.
Well, that's fair. I hope if Scott got bitten in the face by a weird dog, he would consider going to the doctor.
I think he's at least smart enough to do that. And he was at least not stubborn on the when our puppy recently ate rat poison.
Oh.
I was like... Last weekend, I think.
Oh, Atticus.
We caught him in the act. I was like, oh, fuck, what is that? And our friends were like, oh, it's our rat poison. And we were like...
Damn it.
Shit. So, called, like, the MU Pet Hospital, which is the emergency room in Columbia for animals. And we're like, hey, our dog just ate rat poison. We're like, okay, you need to bring him in. were like, oh, yeah, okay.
All right, yeah.
And you gotta make him puke so he doesn't die. Fair enough.
Stupid dog.
Dumb butt. No, we actually, I know this has nothing to do with the book, but we were very happy to find our puppy eating poison because the vet told us that if he had eaten the poison and we didn't know, then he does, like, they don't even get sick right away because it has a delayed start. So, like, the rat or the mouse who eats it, like, goes off to die instead of dying, like, right there. And so she said it might have taken, like, up to a week before we noticed he was acting weird, and by that time he would have already been, like, completely fucked up.
You would have just had a dead puppy.
Yeah.
Well, that would be sad.
So, right, he's on vitamin K, he's doing fine. All so right. I was like, wow, thank God I caught my puppy eating rat poison.
And in defense of the puppy, a human baby of the same age would be equally willing to do that.
Oh, yeah. We decided that baby animals and humans both actively have the will not to live. Because they just try to kill themselves as much as possible.
That's why being a parent is stressful. I guess Janie never had to do that.
That was something I did think was interesting. We totally did not
talk. I say we totally did not talk about that earlier.
That Janie never had a kid, and I thought that was really interesting that she never had a baby.
Yeah, that's.
And it was like never an issue. Like Joe was never like, "Why aren't you having kids for me?"
That's true. It just didn't enter the thinking for some reason.
Mm-hmm.
Was there that little sex going on?
Well, I know they, when they first got married, they were having a lot of sex.
Right.
Because it mentions that, but yeah, I don't know what the deal was. Maybe that's one of the feminist aspects of the book, is that Janie got to, like, discover who she was without being tied down by, like, kids or a husband. I don't know. But
interesting.
That is interesting, actually.
To let that idea percolate around my brain. See if it pops back up later in the podcast.
Well, considering, like, her grandma and mom both had unwanted pregnancies, right. Like, it kind of would have made literary sense for, like, maybe Tea Cake to get her pregnant and for her to have, like, a wanted pregnancy finally and kind of break, like, the chain, but
I don't know.
Who knows?
She was probably too old by then, given the way this book is written.
Yeah.
Anyway, going back to Janie and Joe.
Yeah, sorry about that, like, giant
tangent. But Joe, you know, the main reason that they are not a good couple over time is because he really wants I was saying earlier, not so much a trophy wife, maybe more a political wife.
Mm-hmm.
But that means that, like, all of the fun, free-spirited things, she's supposed to have too much dignity to get involved in it.
Yeah, like, she doesn't get to hang out with the other ladies because they're common women, and she has to be above them. And, like, there's this huge plot going on where, like, this guy in town has this mule that he doesn't take very good care of, and everyone's always giving him shit for it, and Janie convinces Joe to buy the mule from him, and then everyone's like, oh, Joe, you're so great for, like, buying that mule, and then when the mule dies, the whole town has this, like, ridiculous, like, over-the-top funeral for the mule.
Funeral, yeah.
They're having, like, an awesome time with it, and Janie doesn't get to go to the mule funeral and has to sit in the store, even though the entire town goes and no one's going to come to the store.
That episode was quite amusing. Except the part where she didn't get to go.
Yeah.
Right.
Well, I guess she meant Tea Cake, so.
It was like the town, it was like the town's hobby for a while. It was just making jokes about the mule.
Every time that guy showed up, they're like, hey man, where's your mule?
How's your mule? Shut up, guys! Stop making fun of me and my mule!
And ran away because it didn't want to do any fucking work anymore. You should also mention, since I was talking earlier about the 60 acres of land being a play on 30 acres and a mule, if the mule in this book is not supposed to be a joke about 30 acres and a mule, then I will give back my English degree.
So part of the message here is clearly that the land and the mule won't make you happy.
Yeah, and that, like...
Even if you do get it.
That mule that they do have is kind of just worthless.
It's kind of a crappy mule.
Yeah.
It's not even a good mule.
We read a short story when I was in college that was also a playoff of the 30 Acres and a Mule thing, where this young boy in the story, like, gets his hands on his dad's gun or something. He's really excited, and he runs out in the wood to shoot it, and he's never shot in a gun before, so he doesn't know they have recoil, and he shoots the gun, and it recoils, and, like, you know, he Fs up his arm, and the gun goes flying out of his hand or whatever, and when he, like, finally regains his bearings, he realizes that he accidentally shot and killed the family mule.
Oops.
So the entire story is kind of about that 30 acres and a mule thing, but kind of reminded me of that. Although in this case, the poor mule's just old and it just dies.
Yep.
But yeah, that's the whole thing, is Jane's like, well, I want to go too, and Joe's like, you are too dignified to go to a mule funeral. And she's like, no, I'm not.
She's like, no one is too dignified to go to a mule funeral.
Come on, man. And that's like Janie's whole thing, is, like, she wants to participate and be, have relationships with people, and, like, she wants to let her hair down and, like,
Joe literally let her hair down.
Literally let her hair down, and literally and figuratively.
That's right.
And Joe makes her keep her hair wrapped up in this headscarf so other men can't look at her hair and want her.
It's apparently her best feature.
Yeah. People love her hair. So he basically just keeps her restrained in a way that she doesn't want, and she realizes if she fights against him, he's gonna beat her, and so she eventually just retreats into herself to do everything he wants, but, like, isn't her. So she's just kind of being, like, the shell of a wife, saying, like, oh yeah, okay, yes dear, I'll do what you want, but she's, like, not invested in any of it.
Yep.
Which makes him mad.
Right. Until finally they are completely estranged.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not until he's on his deathbed that she... I mean, she hasn't even been in communication with him for weeks while he's been ill. And she finally goes up there and is like, look, you're about to die and you need to know that you're a twat.
Yeah. It's like one of the greatest deathbed confrontation scenes ever. Because you would expect, like, oh, maybe... Like, she wants them to reconcile, and he'll, like, apologize, and instead she goes in there, he's like, what are you doing here? Get out of here! And she's like, I will not! I need to tell you about how terrible you are! And he's, like, literally about to die, and she's just, like, harping on him for being a piece of shit, and it's awesome. I loved that scene.
Well, and that kind of, you know, begins to... That's really the beginning of her... figuring herself out, maybe.
Yeah, because, you know, it's talking about, you know, the funeral is everything it's supposed to be, and she calls out the window and, like, dresses the exact way she's supposed to be and acts the exact way she's supposed to, but on the inside she's like, ooh, 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 ooh. On the outside, you know, she's, like, mournful with the black veil, but she's actually, like, super excited.
And I guess she, well, it's... I'm not exactly... I'm sure this would need to be a classroom discussion point, so I'll bring it up, but there are people in town going, well, you need to get yourself married off again, like, a month or two after. Uh-huh. And she's saying, no, it's not time for that yet. I don't want to do that. I was just married.
Yeah.
And then, like, a month later, she meets T-Cake, and they're like, now, it's much too soon. Why are you...
Why are you interested in that young man?
And that's, well, and, you know, partly they're mad because every man in town was hoping the rich widow would marry them.
Yeah.
But I thought that little turnaround was kind of interesting, and then it, you know, one of her better sayings came out of that, though. Why should I be in mourning if I ain't grieving?
Yeah.
That is a good question.
She admits all that stuff to Phoebe. Not to draw too many parallels between this book and Gone with the Wind, because I do have problems with Gone with the Wind. I think it is much more racist than this book, which I do not find to be racist. Scarlett in Gone with the Wind, kind of the same thing happens where she's married to this guy she doesn't really care about, and then he dies, and you know, according to Southern society, you have to go into mourning and wear all black for X amount of time. She's like, well, I didn't really care about this guy. And, like, I'm at this auction and I want to dance. But she's not allowed to because she has to be a widow for, you know, whatever. So it's kind of the same thing with Janie where she's like, except, well, no, I guess they both end up going against it now that I think about it. But yeah, in Janie's case, she's just like, well, I don't want to be in mourning. So
I'm done.
Yep.
Yep. And meets Tea Cake.
Tea Cake. I don't remember his real name because everyone calls him Tea Cake.
They only called him by his real name at the trial. That was the only time.
The white people were like,
yeah, right.
Snarf, snarf, snarf.
Snarf, snarf, snarf. Yes, the, most of the people in the last part of this book have wonderful nicknames.
Beef Stew.
Right.
That, the only reason I remember Beef Stew is because they were all in a restaurant eating, and they were all eating Beef Stew. And the guy who was nicknamed Beef Stew was like, you know I'm gonna be here. There's Beef Stew. That's right. For some reason, that, like, struck me as hilarious.
Well, and these people in the last part of the book are very lively people for the most part, too. So, you know, they kind of are hilarious. I mean, it's Tea Cake. It's Tea Cake's primary trait, perhaps, is he's full of life.
Mm-hmm.
Full of energy.
He wants to go out and do stuff. And
he doesn't worry about things.
And he wants Janie to come out and do it with him.
Yes.
Which is the important part. Because Ben and I were talking, there's one point in the book where he throws this big party and he's gone all day and she doesn't know where he is and she's freaking out. She thinks he's, like, left her or he's dead or something. And then he comes back and he's explaining the whole thing and, like, well, I had this party and I was going to come get you a couple times, but then I remembered that, like, you were too fancy for the common folk. And she's like, no.
Oh my god, I came with you because I'm not too fancy.
Yeah, like, you better invite me to all of your parties.
And to his credit, in the future he did.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, when they go to the Everglades to work in the fields, well, he's working, she's at home all day, and after, you know, like, a week or something, he's like, he keeps sneaking back home. He's like, right. I miss you. She's like, why don't I just come work out in the fields with you? And starts proving to everyone down at the Everglades, too, that she's not, like, some high and mighty person who's above them somehow.
Right. Like, I guess she looks fancy. She has very regal features.
She's part white.
Right. Which is part of it.
Yeah.
Which I guess is part of why she has this beautiful hair, because it's long, but it's not quite white, but it's not quite black.
And, yeah.
Like, it's just interesting.
Mm-hmm.
Exotic, maybe, is the word. And, this is... This is kind of along the same path, but a lot of mixed-race people, really interesting, like, in a good way.
Yeah, they look, like, way cooler. Not to objectify mixed-race people, but...
I know, but I know, like, it's one of those things when you run into the... I guess there's, in some way, like, some people kind of embrace it, and some people who are racist kind of fear it, but, like, we're all just gonna be this homogenous mixed thing eventually. It's like, well, is that really so bad?
Yeah.
Especially since science keeps saying more and more that the whole racial thing is 100% in our heads and has no physical, biological reality whatsoever.
And it kind of reminds me of dogs, actually, because you know, like, how a lot of purebred dogs have, like, weird health issues.
Yeah.
And if you get a mixed breed dog, they actually tend to be healthier because they don't have, like, they don't have the weird purebred stuff going on. And so maybe that's why mixed race people are more attractive, because you're getting them out of
healthier.
The purebred race, quote unquote, like, making them a mixed race and getting rid of all the dumb issues. I mean, that's just total bullshit.
But... yeah, right. Versus when white aristocrats marry each other only for a couple of centuries.
Yeah, and all their kids are, like, hemophiliacs and super ugly. And, like...
except being ugly, pale, mediocre people.
Like, Charles V has the biggest chin of all time. It is amazing. Like, all the portraits of him. And, you know, portraits were, like, even idealized for royalty, so they looked better.
True.
And even in his portraits, he just has, like, the ugliest, biggest chin. And you're like, inbreeding.
Amazing.
It's awesome. So, moral of the story. White people are the worst. Wait.
We always seem to come around to that.
But yeah, with Tea Cake, Janie finally gets to do what she always wanted to do, which was be with someone she loves, which she has with Tea Cake, and, like, go out and get to experience the world, which is what she wanted to do, and she finally gets to do it with him, so he ends up being a good match for her.
Yes, and it's wonderful and freeing and all those things, and, of course, it's literature, so there has to be a tragic ending.
I do think the tragic ending in this case is really interesting, because I've never read another book where, like, one of the human characters gets rabies, and that's how they die.
True. That is a little bit different. It was maybe just a touch of the beloved person who goes mad at the end of their life, because that's definitely at least something of a trope.
Uh-huh.
But in this case, it happens very quickly instead of being a thing that you have to deal with or, you know, lock them in a room in the attic and hope they don't sneak out and burn your manor house down.
Hey,
wait a minute.
And one of the things I read in the forward to the book that I thought was kind of an interesting point that the person who wrote the introduction brought up was that you can see Janie, because Tea Cake gets rabies and is like in one of his weird manic violent mood swings from being sick, and is trying to shoot her, and she ends up shooting him, and this person writing the foreword said, well, you could either see it as self-defense, because he was trying to kill her, or you could view it as a mercy killing, because he wasn't Tea Cake anymore, and so Janie was just putting him out of his misery, basically.
I think we're supposed to get a little of both out of it. It's kind of how I read it. Like, in the moment, it was self-defense, and I think the reason she can live with herself is because it's a mercy killing.
Yeah, she knew that he was going to die anyway. And that was one of the reasons the black community initially in the book is really pissed at her. Because they're like, why would you kill Tea Cake? He's such a great guy. Like, he would never do a violent act ever. And they think she's just this horrible person. And then once they realize, like, that he had rabies and stuff, then they all come around and forgive her, but...
Right.
Rabies made Tea Cake the opposite of what he was.
Mean, turn him jealous, into a mean, paranoid...
Kind of Joe, almost.
Almost.
Joe never tried to shoot Janie, but...
Well, like a violent, insane version of Joe.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
Like, all of a sudden, controlling and fearful and...
Mm-hmm.
He had always been carefree and whatever the opposite of controlling is.
Yeah. Not controlling. That's the opposite of controlling, right?
I want a better word than that. this would be a good time to transition into some of the issues, perhaps.
Yeah. So, one of the things Ben and I were talking about is... Well, we were saying at the beginning of the podcast that Janie's kind of defined by her journey, and her journey's kind of defined by these, like, three different relationships that she has. And so one of the, you know, feminist arguments that you can make about the book if you want to is how feminist is Janie really, because she only, like, is able to self-actualize through her last relationship. And, you know, if you're doing the good feminist thing, then you're like, well, she should be able to do that without a man's love or whatever. But then Ben and I were talking about it, and we were thinking, well, you know, how feminist is Janie? Maybe not so much, but does it really matter how feminist she is?
It's a very personal story in this case.
Mm-hmm.
And unless Zora Neale Hurston was setting out to write something specifically feminist, which, after having read the book, I'm going to say 99% sure, no, that was not meant. Like, maybe it doesn't really matter. And for that matter, I mean, I guess if you really want to get deeply into a debate on feminist stuff, there are a bunch of different camps, as I understand it. And I'm sure there are some people out there who would say, well, she's experiencing the world through the context of relationships, just like all of us do. And does that make it... Does it make it not feminist just because she dared to love a man?
Yeah.
Certainly anti-feminists would. People who think feminism is bad because they're cavemen. Those who could string a complete sentence together might make that kind of argument.
Well, in the other... I guess what I would consider the feminist aspect of it is that the book is from the point of view of a black woman... giving you a look at her inner self and feelings and personal life at a time when black women were not necessarily viewed as people with inner selves. So making this book all about a black woman's inner self, kind of is in of itself a feminist act.
Yeah, I mean, if you're going to look at it through that lens or through a racial lens, I think you can make very similar arguments. And when the book was first written, a lot of the critics of the day had... A lot of the black critics of the day had problems with it not being radical enough. You know, in the foreword to the edition I read, apparently one of the black critics even went so far as to say, this is like the literary version of a minstrel show. It's entertainment for white people. Which... Again, having read the book, I kind of have to disagree with. But, I mean, not everything that sends a message is necessarily setting out to send some huge message. Like, a personal journey is still saying something. I just don't see how it's useful to criticize something through the lens of, well, here's this ideal, and if it doesn't exactly fit that, then it doesn't count.
Yeah, like... Hurston wasn't saying, everyone should be exactly like Janie.
No.
She was just like, this is Janie's deal, and there you go.
I'm pretty sure if you read Janie's story, you would hope most people don't have to be exactly like Janie. She has to go through a long period of self-denial, and then has to go through a sizable tragedy, and right after she really finds happiness.
Yeah.
And to be fair, she seems to come out of it on the other side pretty well.
Yeah.
But, because we do get a little glimpse of her life after Teak Cake's death.
And she's definitely going to keep doing her thing.
Right. And all of the little synopses I've read of this story, the back of the book jacket, like something online, the library catalog, whatever, they all mention her being a strong, independent woman. So... You know, I'm not even sure I got that out of her until the end of the book, honestly. And so I think there's been, I mean, part of the nature of it being a classic, but I think there's definitely been a lot of reinterpretation of what the meaning of this book is or is supposed to be. Because the book was written during the height of the Harlem Renaissance. And then the black community was very concerned with, how does this portray black people and white people? Like, this one doesn't make black people look oppressed enough.
Yeah.
Was basically the criticism. And I think when it was rediscovered in the 1970s, something written by a woman was definitely going to be reinterpreted through a more feminist lens. And go, oh, well, you know, this is a strong, independent woman. And I think I do think there are elements of that in the book. It's mostly about... It's very personal. Like we said at the very beginning, it's hard to read this and go, oh, well, there's a big message.
Yeah.
Other than one woman's journey.
Yeah, and I mean, if there is a message or a theme, Ben and I figured it's got to be the message of self-actualization and, like, realizing who you are and what you want and doing that.
Yeah.
And not letting society box you in.
There are probably 100 ways to put that, right? The be true to thine own self, or...
or whatever. But I mean, that's essentially what Janie is doing, and I think Janie would argue that it's made her life better to pursue what, you know, she's always wanted to, and I think a lot of people would make that argument that...
Sure.
That makes your life better.
Well, if I can make a slightly far-out comparison for just a second, I've started my long-awaited replay of Persona 4.
Oh, God.
Right, but what basically happens in that game is each character you meet and add to your party goes through this phase of uncertainty and denying themselves in this, you know, other world that causes, like, this aspect of their persona to become this giant monster that you have to defeat. And once you do it, they can accept themselves. So I'm just saying, it's the same theme presented in a very, very different way.
Very different way, yeah.
But it is a constant and regular theme, I would say, throughout storytelling genres.
Yeah, for sure.
And it's a good one.
Yeah.
Let's see. And so, there are a couple of maybe points of interest I want to touch in that are kind of pseudo-related to this issues thing.
Okay.
And thematic stuff, maybe. Probably not thematic stuff so much. but there is this little thread of what we today would definitely call domestic violence.
Yes.
And that doesn't seem to be a particularly big deal in the context of this story.
It is not necessarily presented as the worst thing ever.
It seems to be taken for granted that this is part of what occurs in a marriage.
Mm-hmm.
And even Tea Cake does it once, though in that case it's not to send a message to her, it's to send a message. We were very confused about this.
Ben and I were trying to figure this out. If anyone could please explain it to us. Essentially, there were some people over, someone makes a comment, they get too big for their britches, and somehow Tea Cake slapping Janie teaches his guests a lesson. And we weren't sure what that meant. And the people who heard about it, we're all, like, really proud of him because Janie just kind of allowed him to slap her and then didn't do anything. And they're like, well, if I slap my wife, she'd be, like, all around town yelling it to everybody. I'm like...
Or if I slap my wife, she'd beat the shit out of me, for that matter.
And, to a modern-day reader, I was like, well, she should do that. Yeah. Like, you shouldn't be allowed to just slap your wife. But there was something in the way that TK slapped her that was okay. And, I mean, he didn't, like, do it regularly or anything, but...
Right, it was the one time, and it was for a specific purpose that was not personal, and therefore it was okay or something.
Yeah, we didn't really get that.
We were struggling, we have been struggling a lot to try to put that in our context.
Well, we get why it's bad that Joe was hitting her, because, you know, he was saying, oh, if you don't fit the way I think a wife should be, then I'm gonna hit you. And so she started doing what he wanted so he wouldn't hit her, and, like, I think most readers would understand, okay, like, that's bad, you shouldn't treat your spouse like that, but then we didn't really get the Tea Cake hitting her thing.
No.
Because Tea Cake seems like an all-around good guy, but...
Again, there seems... my general takeaway of that whole issue from this book is that there's some sort of cultural context going on for it that I don't really understand. Because, again, it was so taken for granted, like, there was there's not really a big exploration of any of that. And it wasn't even with the first two husbands, it wasn't even like, oh, well, here's an example of why they're awful. It was just like, nah, these two aren't really meant for each other.
Yeah.
Whereas now her leaving, you know, her chewing Joe out on his deathbed would be, like, part of some Lifetime movie revenge fantasy, I'm pretty sure. Because that's how we see it now.
Yeah.
For
sure.
And so, yes, maybe there is a cultural context that's going on that I don't know even the first step into.
Yeah.
And to be fair, having studied history, I know there are many things significantly more horrible than that were taken for granted at the time.
Yeah.
So it's not impossible for me to think that there is a cultural context that could possibly explain that.
Yeah.
And then the other thing was Mrs. Turner.
Oh, uh-huh.
From the Everglades, who was another black woman of, I guess in her case, saying she had exotic features would be a polite way of saying she looked fucking weird. But she also did not have a standard, did not have standard black person features.
Yes.
And she had this really, really bizarre, like, hatred of black people, basically.
She was a racist snob, even though she was also, if not, like, black, at least partially black.
Right.
Know?
I guess it's kind of that idea of, like, in India, right? Like,
yeah.
The lighter colors are more desirable than darker colors, at least to some people.
I was going to compare it to colonialism as where, like, in those sorts of cultures, becoming white or light starts becoming desirable, because those are the people who have the power, and then the dark people get the shaft. So, like, yeah, when you're lighter, you do better, and that's kind of the attitude Mrs. Turner has taken, where she thinks Janie is great, because we know Janie at least has a little bit of white heritage, and so she has, like, a couple of Caucasian features you can kind of see in there, and she's a little lighter skinned, and so Mrs. Turner really admires her for the whiteness in her, which Janie doesn't give a shit about.
Right, yeah, to her that's not important. It's, I like some people because they're likable people, and I don't care for other people because I don't care for them, and their relative level of whiteness or blackness has nothing to do with it.
Well, Mrs. Turner keeps saying, well, why did you marry Tea Cake? He's right. So dark. And Janie's like, because I love him.
Right.
And he's a good guy.
Yeah, you old biddy.
And Tea Cake's like, fuck Mrs. Turner.
Yeah, he does not like her. Understandably so.
Yeah, understandably.
I felt like I had to bring that up at some point, because, again, if you were in a classroom setting, that is definitely something that would get discussed.
It reminds me of my friend Saeed, who is a lighter-skinned Indian guy, and apparently when he was younger, his grandmother used to tell him in the summer not to go out, not to play outside, because he would get dark, and that was, bad, because he wouldn't get as good of a wife or whatever it was.
Right.
And he was like, Grandma.
It's like, huh?
What?
I'm 4. I don't really know what you're talking about.
I'm going
to go play. All right. So I think we're doing a pretty good job on a lot of this stuff.
Yeah.
I guess you talked about, we basically mentioned the symbols. I'm only going to pause for 30 seconds and mention them briefly again.
Yeah, the mule as the,
the 60 acres and the mule.
Right, it's the realization of, like, the Black American dream that ended up being much more fucked up than promised.
Right, and then the bees and the blossoms, and this is marriage.
Right, which is just a completely literal symbol. Like, by the way, guys, nature and sex. She just spells it out for you, right. So you don't even have to try and get it.
And then,
my point of interest,
oh, right.
is not really literary or moral, like a lot of the stuff we've been talking about. I was just kind of interested, like I said, that Tea Cake dies of rabies, and that, we kind of looked it up a little bit, and rabies works the way it works in this book. We were surprised that they had the serum they could give you right after you got bitten to keep you from developing it, and it turns out that that serum was made in 1885, so it would have been around in the real history of the book, which surprised both of us.
Yes.
I always think modern medicine is a lot more modern when I'm like, oh, there was a vaccine in the 1800s? Like, that's crazy.
The only thing that had even occurred to me that something like that could be around is because I read a book on the influenza epidemic, the 1918-1919 uh-huh. influenza epidemic a year or two ago, and they there was a section on that about how did they produce some different serums and some of the researches they were trying, which of course none of them worked. Mm-hmm. But I was, when I was reading that, I was going, really? Was it that long ago? Like, he basically, in my head, medicine up until the discovery of antibiotics was basically like leeches.
Yeah. Like, just barbaric, cutting people open, draining their blood into a pan, and be like, there, I fixed it.
Right, and now I guess I've reset that view ever so slightly, and now I'm like, everything before Louis Pasteur was basically leeches, and that's probably almost as unfair, but probably close to the truth.
There's actually this really interesting book I started reading, mm-hmm. that I need to finish reading, because I started reading a long time ago, but it's about the history of blood transfusions. Mm. And how people started trying to do blood transfusions, like, hundreds of years ago, before they knew anything about blood type and all of that stuff.
Typing, and it probably seemed like this weird crapshoot.
Yeah, or, like, the very earliest ones, they were trying to do animal and human blood, and then that wasn't really working, and they're trying to do, like, other stuff, but then, like, how a bunch of people thought that was, like, horrifying against God scientific experiments, and I don't know. It was really interesting to hear about that history and then also to realize, like, whoa, you know, people hundreds of years ago weren't just, like, necessarily slapping leeches on people. They're like, what if we could give people blood who needed it? Like, that's a pretty modern thought. So it's nice to remember once in a while that our ancestors weren't just, like, dumb idiots.
Right.
Like, people back then were smart, too, and, like, trying new things. And I'm sure in 300 years, everyone's going to be like, God, people in the 2000s were fucking dumb.
Oh, man, I am going to expand on those thoughts in just a minute when we get around to what we've been reading.
Yeah, so rabies. Rabies works that way. Yeah. And that was just amazing, but most of the point I wanted to.
That's right. So, strengths and weaknesses of the writing.
Yeah, so here, I don't know if I classify it as a strength or a weakness, but both Ben and I kind of had a tough time reading it because of the use of dialect. And I wouldn't call that a weakness, because Hurston's using the dialect for a purpose, and, like, once you get used to it, it's not as difficult. So it's hard for me to say, like, oh, well, she should have just written it like she wrote, you know, the narration in the book, too, because then it would have been easier to read. But at the same time, it would have been easier to read. Right.
And, I mean, that was a choice by the author. She wants it, however hard that is to read, she doesn't care. She wanted it to be that easy or hard to read. Mm-hmm. But it did take me a little bit of effort to get through this one. You know, I probably took a week or maybe even slightly more than that to read this piecemeal.
It's not really that long of a book.
No, it's really not. As you say, like, basically the second I finished it, I read two books that were probably both 2 to 3 times longer than this in 3 days total. It's been like an orgy of reading. But it was a little tricky. My comment was that it felt like assigned reading.
Yeah, and the thing that ended up happening for me was that, yeah, it was difficult to read, and then when I finished, I can go back and look at it and say, oh, here are all, like, the things of value to discuss in this book. So even if I didn't really enjoy reading it that much, like, I think there's a lot of good stuff in there that you can take away from it.
Yeah, certainly. Well, it's definitely in the category of too short for there to be unnecessary stuff in there.
Yeah.
Like, anything, something this short, if there's a bunch of unnecessary passages, then the whole thing's probably unnecessary. It's like, maybe this is a short story idea, not a novel idea. But, I guess let's roll that over a little bit. Like, a kind of, as far as how much we enjoyed the book at the end of it, I definitely did not have a great time reading the book, but I think once I finished it, on balance, I think I like it a little more than I don't. And, I mean, the my entire negative reaction to it is wrapped up in the trouble I had reading it. So it's not really fair to the content to slam it just because I had trouble reading it.
Yeah, I would say the same thing about myself, is that I was like, I don't really want to read this, like, it's kind of tough, I'm not really in the mood right now. Right? But then when you finish it, you're thinking about, like, oh, like, is there anything in particular I didn't like? And the only thing I can really think of is, well, the dialect is kind of hard to read.
I'm glad to have things like this in my background, though, I think, is part of the reason that I decided on balance I like it more than not. Because I know some point, like, 3 years down the road, I'm going to be able to go, oh, that's interesting. It's kind of similar to Their Eyes Were Watching God. And I'll be like, oh, yay, a reference not to a dead white person.
Yeah.
Like, I'm at least somewhat succeeding in being well-rounded. Yes.
I was telling Ben that in the foreword to mine, the author mentions Toni Morrison's Beloved, which we've also read, and I was like, all right, not totally ignorant.
I'm going to... I usually ask you what you're reading right now, but I'm going to kick off because I want to reference back to what you were just talking about with science a minute ago.
Okay.
But I just finished reading The 4% Universe by Richard Panik. And it's basically about the 20th/21st century history of cosmology, the study of the universe. Because at the beginning of the 20th century, it was considered metaphysics and a pseudoscience. And then as we started to learn things about physics and science and the universe, they were able to actually start getting useful data out of experiments aimed at figuring out what the nature of the universe is, you know, whether it's expanding, how it actually started, how it's possible for things to be distributed the way they are, the way forces interact, and all that kind of stuff. And one of the big threads in that book was that, Newton comes up with gravity and all these explanations for the world as we see it, and then there was part of it he didn't quite get, and he's like, well, you know, and God. All right. Which might be where the phrase God of the Gaps comes from, actually, now that I think about it. But then Einstein has his theory of relativity, because really that was the next huge revolution in physics, and he says, okay, so here's all this stuff that has to be true about the universe, except there's this one little chunk we can't quite figure out, so in the equation I'm just going to call that lambda, and that's going to be our cosmological constant. And then for a lot of years people went, well, we're just going to set that at zero because we don't know what the hell it is. And then in the kind of recent past, we apparently now think there has to be some sort of number there for lambda. But for a long time that was compared to God.
Uh-huh.
And Newton's explanation, and Einstein himself said, yeah, that's probably not a thing, before his death. And it wasn't until, you know, like the 1970s or 80s when we could take accurate enough measurements to go, oh, actually, maybe there does need to be something in there. And it wasn't really anything close to proven in a scientific way until very recently. But when I finished the book, I kind of went, man, someday they're going to look back on our era of physics, cosmology, like all this stuff, and go, you know, those people are just guessing about shit. Like, you're talking about this dark matter and dark energy making up 96% of the universe, and they didn't even know what they were looking for.
Yeah.
Like, that, I can't help but wonder if that's going to look horrifically clueless in 2 centuries time.
Right, like, either like, God, they got everything so wrong, or like, they got shit right, but they didn't know why the fuck it was right. How'd they do that?
Oh, those cute 21st century people and all their science. Like in the 24th century when they actually discover God or something.
Right. Like, God is science, and they're like, ah, ha, ha, ha.
He's real and someone meets him. All those cute people in the past.
Oh, man. That's silly.
So, anyway, Yes, and since it's been so long since we podcasted, I also, the other books I had referenced were a pair of Carrie Ryan novels, The Forest of Hands and Teeth, which was a reread, and The Dead Tossed Waves, which is, which she calls a companion, not a sequel, so I will do the same. Anyway, what were you reading?
I just finished The Moonflower Vine by Jetta Carlton. It's about, well, one of the reviews said it was kind of like a modern day Little Women, but I actually do not agree with that. The only reason I think people made that comparison is because it's about a family and they live like on a farm in Missouri and there are four daughters. So right there, okay, like Little Women, right? But it's nothing like that. Because when I first started reading it, I could kind of see the comparison. You kind of have this, like, setup of here's this family in, like, the 50s and blah, blah, blah. And then it goes back and does all these flashbacks. And really, the main purpose of the book is each chunk of it's kind of narrated by a different person in the family. And you learn, oh, here's what this person did and the secret that they held and, like, what it led to them doing. And then you go to the next section and you find out how, like, that first person's secret played off of everyone and how, like, the second person acted in their secret. And basically it's just, like, everyone kind of had, like, a secret. And each time you learn one, like, it opens everything up even more. And then in the last five pages, it's like, boom! End of book. And you're like, what the fuck? So, I mean, there was some, like, the down-home folksy stuff going on. And as a Midwesterner, it was really interesting to read, too, because it was written by a Midwesterner. It's set in Missouri, and so, like, some of that felt really familiar. Not that we're from the Ozarks, but some of that Midwestern stuff, you know?
Right.
And I was just surprised, because when I started it, I was bored, but I was like, I'm going to keep going, because I've heard so many good things. And I got to the end, and I was like, that was a damn good book. So, and it was the only one Jetta Carlton ever wrote, so.
Huh.
Moonflower Vine. There you go.
Go figure. I was actually just thinking, based on the Little Women comparison, that if we ever got tired of doing our plot synopsis for every book, we could do a vague and not very accurate marketing comparison for every book. Yeah.
We should do that.
We'll see if I can come up with a dozen of those for our year in review episode.
Oh, there you go. That sounds good.
Which is coming up, by the way. If you guys have any comments or questions for us, then you can leave a comment on our website, novelideaspodcast.com.
And we actually did just have someone leave a comment, so thanks, Adam.
In fact, we did. He said some very kind things to us, and I may or may not, well, actually, I'm definitely willing to, or may or may not actually go nerd out on military stuff as it relates to Starship Troopers at some point.
Yeah, he's actually a military guy, so it'd be interesting to talk to him, I think, about that book.
Indeed.
You can email us, novelideaspodcast@gmail.com.
We are on Twitter, @novelideaspod.
And you can also find us on iTunes.
Yes, and if you do rate, review, comment on iTunes. The plan for the next couple weeks.
Yeah, aforementioned wedding that is happening in less than 3 weeks now.
Ooh.
Which is frightening. Not because of the marriage, just because, holy God. So, we are hoping to record next week Old Man's War by John Scalzi. So, we're picking up another Scalzi book.
Yeah.
And then we want to do our year-end review after that. And that'll be the week before my wedding, and then the week right after my wedding, and then my honeymoon. So, in that 3 week span of time, we're going to get out a year-end review episode. Not sure exactly when. And then the plan is that we'll pick out the next couple of books that I can read on my honeymoon, because I can knock out two books in a week if I don't have to be at work. No problem. And then hopefully when I come back, we can get back on a more regular schedule.
Hopefully. We're hoping the next couple weeks to put episodes up, and then there will definitely be
a gap.
Some amount of gap, and then we'll hopefully get back into the swing of things. If you have anything specific you want to comment on for anything from the last year, if you go to our episodes page, I have it divided up. There's a dividing by line season. On there. just calling each year a season. And so if you want to double check which ones we've done in the last year, you can go look there. If you had any comments or questions about any of those books, please send them in, or just about anything in general. Last year's review, I thought, went pretty well. Mm-hmm. Got a couple of compliments on it, so I know at least a couple of listeners.
People actually bothered to listen to it.
And we'll be trying to, along with doing our top five and bottom five for the year, we'll be trying to come up with some fun little games and comparisons between the stuff we did like we did last year.
Yep.
So I'm actually looking forward to that episode myself.
Me too.
That was a fun one.
The prep work's kind of fun for that
one. We even had to record the stupid thing twice last year because we had technical difficulties. So
and it ended up not too bad.
Yeah. So I believe that will do it this time.
Yep.
And we'll see you hopefully in a week.
Yep. Bye. Who says today's a fun day? Why do I feel like sinning again? Honey, it's you, Janie.